Hello and welcome to Ordinary, a podcast that aims to help Christians live for Christ in everyday life. My name is Josh Bannister, and each week I'm joined by Graham Nichols and Mark Ventham, both pastors of Christ Church, Haywards Heath. It's time for our final Ordinary guest of 2019. Last but certainly not least, today we have Krish Kandaya. I won't waste your time telling you what he's all about, I'll let him do that, but today's podcast is centred around the topics of fostering and adoption, perhaps a subject that we don't talk about often enough in our churches. So enjoy the podcast and I'll catch you on the other side.
Hello, my name is Graham Nichols.
And I'm Mark Ventham, and this is Ordinary, and today we have a very special guest, Krish Kandaya, who is the founding director of Home for Good. We'll find out a little bit more about that. How are you doing, Krish?
I'm well, Mark. It's nice to talk to you again after all these years.
Indeed, I was just reminiscing with these guys about how you were the first guy to take me through Wayne Grudem's systematic theology.
Whoa, there you go.
Years ago, where you were teaching me theology in your living room.
Oh my goodness.
Oh, it's going to be 15 years ago now, if not more.
I reckon it's more.
20, actually. It's probably...
Yeah, I reckon it's longer.
Do you know, Mark didn't learn anything, though.
I learned loads.
No, that might be a good thing. I'm not a fan of Wayne Grudem's systematic theology anymore, so...
Oh, Krish, no!
Anyway, they were good days, Mark.
They were happy memories.
So, Krish, what are the sort of main occupations of your life at the moment, and kind of where do you live, and how does that all work? What do you get up to?
Oh, sure. So I live in Oxfordshire with my wife. We have 7 children between us. Some are birth kids, some are adopted, some are fostered. And I run a charity called Home for Good, which is trying to inspire Christians to think differently about kids in the care system. We want people to step forward for fostering and adoption, and also looking after unaccompanied asylum-seeking children.
Right. And is that... This might sound a stupid question, but is that like a full-time occupation? Does it get you involved in other things as well?
I'm very blessed that other opportunities come up. I teach regularly at theological colleges like Regent's College in Vancouver and Regent Park College in Oxford. I get the opportunity to broadcast regularly on Radio 2, and I know you've been on Radio 4 many times as well. It's a privilege I get to do and visit loads of really exciting projects around the world as a result of the work we're doing.
Yeah, is that just through that work, or what other jobs have you done kind of since you knew Mark working in a church in the West Midlands?
So yeah, we used to work at the same church in Warwick. Yeah. I've been a cross-cultural missionary with IFES. I've been the president of a theological college. I've taught apologetics, so had the privilege of working in lots of fun and exciting different environments.
Yeah. So one question we had was just, and we ask it of some of our other guests as well, what's your impression of the church scene in the UK, and then particularly, because I know you travel quite a lot extensively, sort of how that compares with any other places that you've been to or anything like that?
Yeah, I think there's lots of encouragements and exciting things happening around the world. I was just in Hong Kong last week. I got to speak with Joshua Wong, who's a 23-year-old activist who, because of his Christian faith, is, I suppose, the leader of the kind of pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong. Here's someone, you know, a millennial, as you like, trying to live out their faith in a really provocative way. I visited a church in Hong Kong that had gone from 0 to 17 foster families in 2 years because they felt convicted by God that they needed to care for vulnerable children. I'm hearing similar stories in places like Ukraine and in Uganda, and there just seems to be a kind of growing movement around the world that children thrive best in families, and the church is called to care for vulnerable kids, and that's been super exciting to us. And we're seeing that happen across the UK. Christians are becoming known as the most likely people to take sibling groups, or a brother and sister who are in care that need a family. We're coming across people who are single that think they could be great at adopting. We're meeting millennials that are saying, we're not even going to see if we're fertile, we're just going to adopt because that's what God's calling us to. So yeah, really excited. There seems to be a kind of growing movement of Christians living out their faith in a very practical way, and that's making ripples in all sorts of exciting places.
Do you think the church in the UK is more or less united and sort of clear than it was, or I don't know, just your perception really of how it's going generally?
I think there's ups and downs. You know, on some issues we seem more divided than we've ever been. I thought we would have been able to get over issues like whether men or women should be the only leaders of a church. I thought we dealt with that in the kind of 1980s, but it seems to have kind of bubbled to the top again as a dividing line between many churches. I still meet many Christians who debate whether evangelism is the only mission of the church or whether justice is also part of that calling. It seems that social media has kind of tribalized us as much as it's united us. Mm. I was recently watching a video with Eric Metaxas, who's incredibly well-known author for his book on Bonhoeffer and the film that he produced around John Newton and Amazing Grace, promoting basically Donald Trump's policies for primary school children. So, you know, there does seem to be quite a lot of division still there, and I wonder whether social media might be another vehicle to kind of exasperate some of those divisions.
It's the most exciting interview you've ever done, because you're in a restaurant, aren't you, in the middle of London, so which is, if people are listening, hearing the background noise, that's what it is.
You're hearing
it's got
Korean
a kind of buzzy
music.
Atmosphere to it. It's quite cool.
We sound like, you know, we're
I'm sorry about that.
For the first time in our lives. No, you're making us sound good.
I was looking for a quiet place, but this was the quietest I could find, so I'm sorry about that.
No, you're doing it's fine. It'd be good, you know, start thinking about, help us thinking about biblically, you know, why should we be thinking in these ways about adopting children, fostering children, taking this on, in terms of how you see it biblically, how it challenges us as believers, where we go from there.
So I was a pastor in an evangelical free church in Northwest London, and as all pastors of conservative churches feel called to do, I decided to start a series in Romans, because that's what we do, right? Because of thank you, Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones, for spending years walking verse by verse through the book of Romans. That's now an aspiration for many of us pastors. And weirdly, I preached through it without really recognising the doctrine of adoption. And someone like J.I. Packer, who wrote that formidable and excellent book, Knowing God, he would argue that adoption is the highest privilege that the gospel affords us. It's more important than justification. And to be honest, I've heard more sermons about justification than I have about adoption. Packer would argue that justification prepares the ground for God to be able to adopt us. Mm. Adoption is what gives us everything that you find most precious about being a Christian. It gives you God as your Father. That's only yours through adoption. Jesus is the only true Son of God who's there because of, you know, his eternal relationship with God the Father and God the Spirit. But we're invited in to the household of God through adoption. Adoption is what the Holy Spirit comes to affirm in us, that we might cry out to God that we're Abba, that God is our Abba Father. And according to Romans 8, right, the centerpiece of the book of Romans, the whole of creation is holding its breath, longing to see us revealed as the adopted sons and daughters of God. You think, how did I miss that? How was that element of the gospel so invisible to me that I could preach a series over many weeks through the book of Romans and kind of miss it? And to be honest, it's missed in most of the church circles I move in, whether that's a conservative evangelical one, or whether it's a more charismatic one, or a progressive one, or a, you know, the whole range, a Pentecostal one, that we are missing out the doctrine of adoption. It's become the Cinderella doctrine. And I think that's one of the reasons why many Christians are not considering adoption as a normal part of the Christian life, because they haven't really understood their own adoption into God's family. But secondly...
Why do you think that is?
I think we started fighting theological wars over things like penal substitution. And, you know, I'm a believer in penal substitution. I think it's a really essential model of the atonement. But we fought those wars internally, and then it became the litmus test of whether you're really a Christian or not. So every preacher I've ever heard from a conservative setting feels the need to find a way to put penal substitution into their sermon to prove their orthodoxy, rather than preaching the text that's in front of them, and rather than teaching the whole sweep of the doctrine of salvation. So we've kind of focused it down or reduced the gospel down to just an atonement conversation, and that's not where the gospel goes. So it's almost like we spent too much time reading the commentaries rather than reading the text, and we spent too much time fighting internally than actually engaging with non-Christian people outside of the church, and that skewed our understanding of the gospel. So I hear more sermons preached about the gospel from the epistles than I do from the gospels, and I think we need a bigger, more biblically literate gospel that will embrace all of the wonders and glories that the gospel offers us.
Yeah, I think the same would be true of marriage, wouldn't it? That there's also that model throughout the Bible of marriage between God and his people that kind of comes to fulfillment in Jesus and his bride, the church. And but I think we've done a little bit better with that in terms of kind of both understanding it for ourselves as the church, the bride of Christ, but also kind of understanding how it sort of feeds into and in a way kind of learns from the model between a husband and a wife. So I think we do a little bit better in that as a sort of motif. And I think you're right, not so much in terms of adoption. But you were going to do a secondly, so you did your firstly, and there was a secondly coming.
Yeah, secondly, I think we have a reduced understanding of what God asks of us in terms of our worship. So if you ask the average Christian, what does worship look like? You may get something that involves a Sunday service. So it's when we gather to sing hymns, read the Bible, pray for one another. And interestingly, most discipleship courses will have something about Bible reading and prayer and giving and turning up at church. But when the Bible looks to define worship, it doesn't look like that. So let me do two terrible proof texts for you. So one would be Isaiah 58. I was just reading it with some friends this morning, actually. And in the book of Isaiah, God is kind of reviewing the worship of Israel. Isaiah 1, he's very critical. He says, I wish you weren't gathering. Stop your meaningless assemblies. Stop praying. You have not sought to defend the cause of the widow and the orphan. So God's saying, you've substituted caring for the vulnerable for some kind of liturgical, ritualistic worship. And that's Isaiah 1. Isaiah 58 picks up the theme again and challenges Israel about how they've been fasting. You know, is this the kind of fast that I require, just a day to, you know, acknowledge the Lord? And God says, no, this is fasting. It's to share your food with the hungry. It's to welcome the stranger. It's to give drink to the thirsty. And you go, whoa, what's going on? You know, God, the one that invented our gatherings and encourages us to sing psalms to one another and to pray, is saying, actually, this kind of ritualistic worship is no substitute for caring for vulnerable people. And you go, okay, well, that's the Old Testament. Maybe things are different in the New Testament. Well, Book of James, chapter 1, verse 27, what do you get? Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and blameless is brilliant expository preaching, fantastic singing on a Sunday, whether with a worship band or with an organ. No, that's not where the verse goes. The verse says, religion that God our Father accepts as pure and blameless is to care for widows and orphans in their distress. You go, hang on. That's a New Testament concept. You go, oh, right, okay, we're Lutheran. We don't like the Book of James. We think it's an epistle of straw. Is there anywhere else you'd get this kind of thinking from? And you go, okay, well, what about Matthew 25, the clearest parable that Jesus tells about Judgment Day? where the Son of Man separates the sheep from the goats, one from another. You know, what is the differentiating factor of whether you're in the kingdom or not? Well, it's those same words that are used in Isaiah 58. It's to welcome the stranger. It's to share your food with the hungry. It's to offer drink to the thirsty. So it seems biblically that an essential indicator that you belong to the kingdom of God, you're offering God the kind of worship that he deserves, is the outflow of that compassion and mercy you've received from God onto other people. And, you know, for some reason, we, the church, have reduced worship down to an event that we turn up at once a week where we sing a few songs and we take some bread and we take some wine, and we've missed the larger scope of what God actually requires of us.
So just to sort of play back what I think you've said, just to see if I've heard. So your kind of point number one was we don't really have a good biblical doctrine of adoption. Well, not so much a good one, but a conscious front and center doctrine of adoption. And then secondly, you're saying that in terms of our worship, we've got a kind of narrow view. So we're not thinking about whole life worship, you know, of which adoption forms part. Which I don't think me or Mark disagree with that. No. So that's fair. So where do you go with that? What are you trying to do? Now, should all of us who have children feel guilty that we're not adopting? Feel like we're not worshiping properly? You know, how do you know if it's something you should do as part of your worship? You know, obviously you have a particular focus, so you're stirring people up in a good way to think whether they could, how they could, and so forth.
No, I'd say, look, how do you tell whether a church is a biblically faithful church or not? What are the indicators? In many contexts, people would say, well, are people preaching the Bible on Sunday? You know, are the sacraments rightly distributed? Is there church discipline going on? And I'm going, okay, those are good Reformation differentiators between the Catholic Church of its time and the Protestant Reformation churches. But we've used that as the mark of whether you have a gospel church or not, whether you've got a living gospel church or not. And so when you're doing church planting, as long as you're gathering on a Sunday and you're preaching the word and you're distributing the sacraments correctly, you've got a church, big tick. But when the Bible's asking, what does discipleship look like? What do fully formed Christians look like? It's looking more than just people turning up at church, singing some hymns, listening to Bible preaching. It's looking for outworkings of practical grace into other people's lives. And it doesn't mean everyone has to foster and adopt, but there has to be a way we're expressing the mercy and compassion of God in very real, practical terms to those around us. And so if God was kind of offsetting the church's worship, according to Matthew 25, James 1:27, Isaiah 58, Isaiah 1, and a whole host of other, like take the book of Amos, for example, this is what God is looking for. And that's not what we're teaching. It's not what we're preaching. It's not what we're modeling.
So just help us, give us some ideas in terms of what you're thinking, in terms of what will it look like then for us to be showing mercy, you know, so we're not all suddenly called to presumably leave our current jobs, but so what will it look like in the day-to-day for an ordinary believer who's in a regular workplace, let's say up in the city, and they're seeking to worship God in this way, you know, with all of their lives, you know, taking the Romans 12, 1 and 2 kind of idea as well, and putting that into practice in this particular area, what will it look like? Give us some ideas. I mean, obviously, we're going to talk a bit more about, you know, what will it look like to adopt or foster, but what other areas are you thinking, or would you, you know, help someone in that situation?
Yeah. Okay, let's take a practical question. So this ordinary job that you're working in, how did you choose it? How did you know this was the job you were supposed to be doing? Many Christians I know have not really thought very biblically about vocation, about why they're doing the job that they're doing. Many people just fall into it. I speak to a lot of university students in their final year of uni, and I say, hey, what are you planning to do? And they say, we don't really know, haven't really got any plans, unless they're, you know, on a medical course or they're studying law, which is already a kind of vocational journey. Many Christians have not actually thought biblically, vocationally about the work they're doing. So surely one of the indicators that we're in the right kind of job would be, is this job actually helping me to bring compassion and grace and mercy of God into the work that I do? So, you know, the business I work for, what is it producing? What are the outputs of my business? Is my business making people poorer? Is it, you know, impacting the environment? Is it, or is it generating job opportunities for vulnerable people? What's our CSR policy? What's the point of the company? What are we seeking to do? So that everyday job itself, surely we've thought about that from a kind of vocational basis.
Krish, that's a really interesting, I'm really with you. I suppose just to kind of test it a little bit though, that sounds, I'm going to sound a bit rude now, but
go for it.
It sounds quite a sort of middle class, I can make a choice kind of thing. And maybe for many of us, we can't necessarily assess, you know, is my company environmentally friendly? And I'm working, I'm not, but I could say I'm working in reinsurance in the City of London. And I had a good friend who I used to take the mickey out of all the time, who worked in reinsurance, because I said, you absolutely, insurance is bad enough, but reinsurance is really not a proper job. You're just shifting risk around. You're not even shifting money around. Sure. You're not producing anything. You're not really doing anything. Almost, you're worthless, you know, compared to my wife, who's a nurse. You know, your job has no value. Now, I didn't quite say that, and it was kind of tongue-in-cheek, but so just to test what you said, just maybe back on that.
Take insurance. Like, insurance is a social good. It's a form of protection for people who would otherwise be financially at risk. So, you know, all these people that had their houses flooded recently in Yorkshire, many people didn't have insurance. They couldn't afford insurance. Insurance policies weren't built in a way that would help them. And so now they've lost everything. Now they're kind of, you know, their houses are flooded. They've got no form of income. So insurance can be a social good. That can be a way we're showing mercy and grace and providing a kind of backup system for people that are at risk of poverty. So insurance can be good. It doesn't have to be you're doing something hands-on. Nursing is great, but insurance can also be a social good. So I'm just asking people to think Christianly about what they're going to give themselves to and have a wider frame of what it means to seek the kingdom of God. And that can be an insurance. There can be a godly approach to insurance.
That's really helpful. I think Mark's going to ask you a question about adoption, well, because we've got 10 minutes to go.
Well, even less
sure.
than that. So we got to where we are in terms of we've understood biblically. Talk to us now, okay, so we've got a, say, a young couple, and they've been convicted of the scriptures, want to adopt or foster. What would they do next? What are the next steps? What are the things they need to think about some more? What are the issues that they need to work through?
That's a good question. The quick answer is just to phone us. Home for Good's got a dedicated helpline where we'd love to help people through it. And I wrote a book into this to try and help people wrestle biblically, but also practically with what it means to be an adoptive parent or a foster parent. I would say to someone who is thinking about fostering adoption to check whether they feel called by God to have birth kids, because birth kids are a wonderful gift from God. And if you are thinking of having birth children, I would suggest do that first, and you know, let God bless you with your own birth children if that's something you feel called towards. And then you need a 2-year gap between your youngest child and the child that you're able to adopt. And because most of the children that need adopting in the UK are not babies, they're older kids, they're normally kind of 3, 4, 5 and up, and they come in sibling groups, and we don't want to separate brothers from sisters if we can avoid it. You might want to kind of, we're talking about some long-range planning, so that you've had your birth kids and then you're able to welcome other kids into your already formed family. But I have met Christians who have felt called, you know what, we don't think we need to have our birth kids. That's not something we feel strongly about. And so people have stepped forward to foster and adopt straight off the bat. And that can be a wonderful gift that you can give to children too.
Yeah. Can I just ask a related question, or maybe a point three, which you might be able to talk to about the reasons why not? I think some people are not sure how their emotions are going to kind of switch, because they can sort of imagine how it all kicks in. And maybe guys are a bit more prone to that than women. I don't know whether that's
they
true.
Are.
But
you're right.
Yeah. And they're not sure, am I going to love this kid enough, you know, if I adopt it, to be able to properly look after it? And I think that makes some people hesitant. Do you think that's true?
Yeah. I think it's definitely a perception that's out there, and I really want to knock it on its head and call it stupid for what it is. Like someone said to me the other day, I couldn't love some child that I wasn't biologically connected with. And I say, well, hang on, you know, hopefully there's no biological connection between you and your wife. You didn't marry your sister or your cousin. You managed to find a way to love someone who didn't share the same genetic makeup as you. And, you know, if you did marry your sister or your cousin, well, maybe you've got a dog that you would say that you loved. I'm hoping there's no biological connection there. That's a funny definition of love. You know, that's not a biblical definition of love. Again, you know, we're called to love all sorts of people in the Bible. We're called to love our God. We're called to love our neighbour. We're called to love our family. We're called to love our enemies. You know, there's no one excluded from the range of love that Christians are supposed to show in the world. So to say that I could only love someone I had a biological connection with is a sub-biblical understanding of love.
Yeah, no, thank you. Just conscious of time again, there's another perception out there that actually it's quite hard for Christians to adopt because authorities are not wanting Christians per se, concerned that we'll, you know, brainwash with biblical doctrine.
Go against
you know, the, you know, British values. You know, obviously that's not been your experience. What is the case? Is it different areas, or is that just one of those made up kind of ideas and thinking that's gone out?
I think overall it is a misconception. I mean, it would be illegal for any local authority to reject you because you're Christian, because there's something called the Equalities Act of 2010, where faith, as well as a whole range of other kind of identity issues like age and gender and disability and race, are protected categories. So you can't be treated differently because of those categories. But you may come across social workers, and, you know, in yesterday I was doing a training with 50 social workers from across the UK. Most were very positive about faith, and Christian faith in particular, but a small minority maybe had some fears and worries, and an even smaller minority thought Christians shouldn't be doing it. So you might meet the odd social worker that has a real problem with faith, but you could get that with an Uber driver, you know. So
yeah.
I think some groups have kind of catastrophized this to say there's some national conspiracy against Christians fostering or adopting, and that is actively not true. I know hundreds of Christians that are fostered and adopted, and if people do hit a roadblock in that process, they should contact us because we can help them figure a way through, because it would be illegal for someone to be treated differently because of their faith.
That's really helpful. If we had more time, we'd love to talk a bit more about it, but we are almost out of time. Now, Krish, where can people find out more? So if you give us the website for Home for Good and then your sort of social media handles, that would be really great.
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, it's been lovely to talk to you guys. People can contact Home for Good at homeforgood.org.uk, or they can phone us on 0300 001 0995, and there'll be someone there to kind of take your call. A Christian person who can kind of walk you through some of the issues and challenges and opportunities there are to care for kids. And if people want to reach me, I am on Twitter on @ChrisK, and you can find me on Facebook, Krish Kandaya.
Brilliant. It's been great to talk to you, and you can go back to your food now, and I hope you enjoy it.
Thanks so much, Krish.
Thank you.
Speak with
you. All right, take care. Have a good one. Bye-bye. Yeah.
Thanks, Krish. Bye.
Big thank you to Krish for joining us today. If you do have questions for him, then reach out to him through any of those means that he offered on the podcast, or visit homeforgood.org.uk. Or you can get in touch with us on ordinary@cchh.org.uk. Thanks for listening. Join us again next week for another episode of Ordinary.